Series of talks about the Bodhisattva, and in particular taking the vows and precepts of the Bodhisattva. So the kind of impetus behind this is because several people in the dojo will be doing this in May, June at a retreat session near Liverpool. In the first talk I spoke about the kind of spirit of the Bodhisattva. I didn't speak necessarily about the detail of the vows, which we will do later in the series. And in the second talk, I spoke about the three, taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, the three refuges. And that is the first of the first three of the 16 of the precepts that one takes when one receives the Bodhisattva ordination. And what I want to do today is speak about the next three, but I also want to speak more generally about what the Zen approach to ethics and precepts are, because it's quite important to understand that, to see that we have a slightly different perspective from not necessarily all Buddhists, but from some other Buddhist groups, and also from some ways in which other kind of people interpret the idea of having commandments, precepts, etc. The first thing to say is that sometimes, if you read some of the literature that was around in the 1950s, 1960s, Jack Kerouac, maybe Alan Watts, sometimes you get a sense that Zen doesn't have, that it's kind of beyond these things, beyond ethics, precepts, etc. And that's because that's true, but it's also not true. And I think that was probably a bit attractive to the kind of beats and the hippies, that kind of throwing away the old way of looking at things. And maybe they needed that at that time. But it's wrong to say that Zen doesn't have this. It has a different perspective on how we think about these things. And in fact, it's one of the three kind of fundamental pillars of Zen practice. The three pillars are Kai, Jo, E, and in fact that kind of maps onto the Eightfold Path. I won't talk about how that is done, but it's the kind of three aspects of the Eightfold Path. And Kai is precept, ethics effectively, behavior, comportment. Jo is meditation, practice of meditation. And E is wisdom. These are the three Japanese terms for this. And from a Zen point of view, these are all intimately linked. And that the root of the precepts comes from meditation and wisdom, effectively. And so they're not considered separate, but they are something that one has to kind of pay attention to. And the other thing to say about the precepts is that sometimes I'll talk about the kind of absolute and relative perspectives. And one thing to be aware of is that the precepts are really about the relative self, how the relative self engages with the world. And that's in some ways why the beat people kind of maybe missed this aspect, is because they were drawn to the teachings which are more focused on the kind of absolute letting go of the self, which is absolutely a very important part of Zen. But Zen is also about recognizing that it's not only the beyond self, non-self, which we are. We are also the relative self, the relative constructed self. And that relative constructed self is thrown into life, is thrown into the world, and needs to find a way to make sense and to move forward. And among other things to say, one of the reasons for the precepts are partly about, as I was saying about the taking refuge in the sangha, the precepts are partly about harmony with others, harmony with oneself, harmony in the community, and they are to promote harmony. And the reason for promoting harmony is not because you want to be a saint and not evil and go to heaven and not hell, but the reason to promote harmony from a Buddhist point of view is to create space to engage with practice. The more disturbed our lives are, the harder it is to engage with practice. And so the harmoniousness is partly about creating space in which we can practice. And so the precepts, there is an element of that. The precepts, one element of the precepts is creating a life in which one can practice to go beyond the relative self, as well as having a relative self which is in some sense more healthy and affected in the world and doing good for others. So, as I say, the precepts, from a Zen point of view, are grounded on the wisdom that comes from the practice of meditation, the awareness and wisdom that arises from this. And I want to talk about the three pure precepts today, the three pure precepts, which are really about reducing suffering in the world, suffering one's own suffering, suffering of others, suffering of all beings, is what it's about. So it's not about, as again to emphasize, it's not about good and evil. And when we say that kind of following the precepts, being a Buddhist is about being a good person, I've heard a metaphor, I think it was Stephen Batchelor that used this metaphor, which I quite like. It's not good in the sense of good versus evil, but rather it's good in the sense that a good knife can cut well. So a good human can human well. It's in the same way. So it's more about that. It's about playing the role in life which is appropriate for one, as opposed to being a kind of goody person, is what it is. So I would say what those three precepts are, the three pure precepts. The three pure precepts are, first of all, endeavour to do no harm. Endeavour to not cause suffering to others. The second is endeavour to do good, which is endeavour to act in such a way that it reduces suffering. And the third precept is to do this with the spirit of doing it for all beings, as opposed to one's own personal ego. And so we're creating harmony not only so that we can practice, but also so that all beings can find space to be more aware, and those who are engaged with practice can engage with practice because of this harmony. And so it's about endeavouring to not cause suffering to self and others, endeavouring to reduce, through one's actions, to reduce the suffering in the world, and to increase awareness of what's going on. And doing this not for one's own personal ego, not to feel good about, not to feel pleased and proud about what we're doing, but rather doing it for the good of all beings. That does not mean that one's ego might not feel good about something we do. That's okay. That's all right. If we feel good, better to feel good than to feel bad. But nonetheless, the idea is that the precept is that we're doing it for, as an offering for all beings, not for our own personal aggrandizement or benefit. So those were the three pure precepts. Do no harm, endeavour to do good, to reduce suffering, and do this for the benefit of all beings. And there's a story which I quite like, and I don't know if it was a Zen story originally or from somewhere else, but it's about a wise old woman in a village, and a young man goes up to the wise old woman and asks her, what is the secret of living a good life? And she says, the secret of living a good life is to help others and to not cause harm to others. In other words, to follow these precepts which she's talking about. And the young man says, well, that, you know, we've been taught that since we were like six. That's obvious. And the old woman says, yes, it is obvious. It's obvious to even a child, but it's fun, it's really difficult even for a wise old woman to practice. And so it's something about the obviousness of these things, but nonetheless, like Zazen, it's simple, but it's not easy. And similarly, to endeavour to do no harm, to act in such a way to reduce suffering for others, and to do that for all beings, is simple and obvious, but not easy for anybody, any of us. So, as I said, the other two pillars of practice, namely meditation and wisdom, are key, and this is particularly important from a Zen point of view. We see that the practice of meditation helps create clarity in the mind, awareness in the mind, which allows wisdom to arise. And that wisdom is not about knowing what should be done. In other words, it's not a wisdom based on knowledge. It's not a wisdom based on, oh, it's obvious now, I should do this and not do that. But rather, it's a wisdom that's based on seeing the way things unfold in life. I think I quoted Suzuki Roshi last week when I was talking about some of this, that not always so is what is one of the, he said the essence of Zen teaching is not always so. And so we don't have fixed rules about how one should think about or behave about certain things, but rather we see the way things unfold and respond to that unfolding appropriately. We respond to that, and so we do that because we cultivate awareness. We cultivate awareness through practice. Awareness of the way that our minds work, the awareness of the way other people respond to our behaviour, the awareness of the mistakes that we all inevitably make again and again and again. And so we observe the patterns in life, in ourselves and in others. And by seeing and observing the mistakes that we make, and seeing how suffering arises from them, it might be our own suffering, it might be suffering in others, it might be or both, then by seeing that, then we see how these mistakes produce suffering, and we become conscious of them. And as we become conscious of them, then these habits we have inside ourselves, these patterns we have inside ourselves, which come from some combination of our inbuilt nature and the environment that we have lived in through the years, these habits and patterns, we become more conscious of them, and as a result, they become less powerful. So to begin with, we will just continue making mistakes, but we might notice these mistakes more quickly. And over time, we might notice the arising of a feeling which normally manifests in the world, in our patterns, but we notice it arising, and because we're more conscious of it, maybe it's a feeling of anger, because we're more conscious of it, it doesn't express itself in the same way, in the way it used to. And so maybe we don't snap, or we don't, if it's an arising of fear that causes problems for us and those around us, maybe that fear arises, but it doesn't stop us doing something. And so we become conscious of them, and they, as a result of that, they have less power. They have less power because we notice them arising. And this act of noticing over time transforms these patterns. They have, they become weaker, they have less power, they don't dominate us, and over time, in some cases, not always, then they fade away. And this is really the essence of Zen ethics, is to observe the mistakes that we make, try not to feel too guilty about them, try not to beat yourself up. A little bit of guilt is fine, but not too much. And don't let that guilt kind of be something that kind of becomes debilitating. So try not to, but try to observe them, accept them for what they are, and allow the expression of them over time to change, to become something that is maybe is expressed in a less harmful way, or even in a positive way. Sometimes things that are our weaknesses can become something that is expressed in a way which actually is helpful for the world rather than harmful for the world over time. So that is the essence of how we do things in Zen. That's the essence of the practice of Zen from an ethical point of view. What I want to say though is that, so that's, in some way that's an ideal, and sometimes it's the case that some of these patterns are so powerful in us that this kind of natural practice of noticing and allowing things to transform naturally, unconsciously and automatically over time, to quote Master Desshin Maru, is not enough. That there's patterns in us that are too powerful. And as a result of that, we might need to be more active and firm with them. We might need support from others to be active and firm with them. And a really good example of that is things like someone who has an addiction like alcoholism or a drug addiction. It may well be necessary for them to, you know, in the spirit of the Alcoholics Anonymous, to effectively say, the only way I can deal with this is to get support from others and to cut it completely, do my best to cut it completely and never touch it again, because it has such a powerful effect on my body mind that, whereas for other people that's not the case. And for other people, maybe who have no problem with alcohol, maybe they have a problem with something different, like a tendency to accumulate wealth or to want power, and so they might need to work more consciously on something different. And I think it's up to each of us to see which of these patterns are maybe need more of a firm hand. And I would say also, to some extent, that's also the role of a teacher. A teacher might see things in you that you don't notice and make you aware of patterns in you that you don't notice. A skillful teacher will make you aware. And sometimes that can be fairly blunt and direct and stern. Other times it might be more gentle and subtle over time. And I remember Nancy would work in different ways with different people. She had quite a very, 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 Nancy was, I spoke last time I think about Jean, one of our founders. Nancy was the other of our founders, her photo's on the wall. And she was quite a fierce and strong person, but there were some people who she would work with very gently because she was aware that that was just not appropriate for their character and for, what her, for how they were. And so different energies are necessary to the different manifestations of challenges that we have in our lives, the different imperfections that we all live with, because we are beautiful exactly because of our individual imperfections, not despite them. So sometimes we need some help to work on these things, to change those imperfections, still to be imperfections, but to manifest in the world in a way which causes less suffering for us, causes less suffering for others, and maybe even helps people. Yeah. So it's different for each of us. I mean, I mentioned the other week, I think for me, the thing I'm most addicted to is, or the thing I can get addicted to, but I do work on it, I need to be quite firm with it, is doom scrolling news feeds, that sort of thing. That's the kind of thing that I need to work on personally. Or even I can get addicted to my work, which I quite enjoy, but it can get, so I can get addicted to my work and be checking emails and responding to emails at times when I shouldn't be. And so we each have different things which hook in to our self and the aspects of ourselves which I suppose need our personal selves. We're each screwed up in different ways, I would say. And so we each get addicted to things in different ways. And so part of the practice is to see, become more aware of what causes us suffering and what causes others suffering, what pulls us away from awareness. And work on those things, sometimes gently and sometimes more firmly. And so those three precepts, the three pure precepts, endeavour to do no harm, endeavour to do good, to reduce suffering in the world, and do this for the benefit of all beings. In many ways, these are the essence of Zen ethics. And all the other precepts, what are known as the 10 grave precepts, are really already encaptured by those. I'll speak about those 10 precepts later on. Because basically, what they do is they say, okay, given what we've just said about these three pure precepts, there are certain areas of life, like anger, like one's sexuality, like our desire to possess things, where people often make mistakes and often can cause suffering for themselves and for others. And those are areas that maybe we need to be more aware of and pay more attention to. And again, for different people, it will be different things. And so the grave precepts really are just saying, okay, you've taken the three pure precepts, also watch out for these things. Think about how the three pure precepts manifest in these different ways. And I'll talk about those, as I said, another week. So the idea is that the awareness helps to see how you cause suffering, and it's different for each of us, how you cause suffering for yourself and others, how you cause disharmony in your own mind and in those around you. There's a really nice example, which I want to put on the wall. We used to have it on the wall because Deb Sage really liked it. It was Rhea Kanten's precepts. Do you remember those? Yeah, no. I'll put them on the walls. But they're mainly about different ways in which he talks. And I'm going to put that on the wall. Not because I think everyone should follow all of these, but I think they're really nice. And that you get a set. Rhea Kanten was a hermit poet, a Zen hermit poet, a very famous poet who composed haiku and other things. And you get a real sense. He lived on his own, but he would kind of engage with the children in the village. And you get a real sense of his precepts about him noticing exactly the mistakes that he was making and observing them, and then thinking, right, okay, I need to remember. That's something I keep on doing, so I'll write that down and I'll try not to do it again. So it's got a real nice sense around that. So I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, it says things like, so take care not to, and it's all about speaking. So things like speak with a knowing air, carry on while drunk, speak grandly of enlightenment, use flattering speech, speak effectively like an artist, give long-winded sermons. So I better not go off too long today. Yeah, but I'll put that up because it's just a nice thing to read, and you get some sense of him being aware of his own mistakes and then thinking, okay, how can I respond to that so that my conversations with others are more helpful for them and cause me, don't kind of stimulate my ego too much. Yeah. So I wanted to take one example, and in fact I've mentioned Nancy, I want to go to our other friend Jean, to give one example of how we can think about how you go beyond the kind of superficial meaning of a given precept, and then dig into, okay, what's going on behind this? And not to kill, not to inflict violence on others, which is one, you know, the first of the 10 grave precepts. I remember Jean Babi saying that, you know, there's always violence in the world, and he was speaking about violence, and I can't remember exactly, I think it was probably Israel-Palestine again back then. He basically said, the absence of violence is not peace. And the point he was making, and I remember him teaching on this, is that so if you look at a precept like avoid killing, don't avoid violence, etc., what we need to look at is the origins of that within us, rather than the kind of superficial manifestation, because. I don't go around killing people, but nonetheless, those same urges within me, even though they manifest in far more subtle ways. And that is that we all, when anger arises, and particularly when that anger takes a kind of righteous anger, when we feel we are right, and this is something else that Jean used to say. He said that violence is never done in the name of evil. It's always done in the name of good. He used to speak about what he called the demon of good. And the demon of good is where someone believes they know what is right and should force it on the world, effectively. Or it's not even force it on the world. Just be so certain that you're right and the other people are wrong that effectively you can demonize them. And so he would speak about how when we look inside ourselves, we can see the same seeds of violence in our own hearts, which just flick on sometimes when we get pissed off with someone, we think we're better than them, when we're certain that we're right and we want to impose our view on them, and we get angry that they have a different view from us. Even if that anger is not manifest, even if that anger is inside, there's still that same kind of lack of peace in the heart and moral certainty. And this is, again, this goes back to one of the things that's really important about Zen ethics. Moral certainty is seen as a weakness from a Zen point of view. Moral certainty is seen as something that makes us blind and unaware. And moral certainty is something that stimulates anger and stimulates division and prevents reconciliation happening. And so he was talking about the danger of righteous anger. And so as a result of that, it's that when we take these precepts, what we do is we say, okay, where does it arise in our shin, in our heart mind? Where do we see it in ourselves rather than looking to point fingers at others? Where do we see it arising in ourselves? What can we do to promote peace, to reduce suffering, to promote harmony in the world? And that is done by looking inwards and then expressing that in the world in a way which is not dogmatic and certain, but in a way that responds to the situation in which we find ourselves in at that given moment. And again, to go back to what Suzuki wrote, said, not always so. We can't know how to respond in a given situation in advance. And we might respond in what appear to be similar situations in different ways over time, because one needs to do what is right for the people who are in that situation, for the people who are around, do what is right to move things forward. But also I would say that we need to recognise that we will never, ever always get things right. Our personal self is always beautifully imperfect and flawed. And our personal self will always make mistakes. It might be more aware than it used to be, but it will always make mistakes. And that's okay. That's part of life. Just keep on living, keep on moving forward, keep on taking the next step on the path. Yeah. So, key point of this is that we don't hold tight to the vows, which I'll be talking about next step. So, they are not things that we, kind of firm things that we believe every single other person should do, and then we hold an attitude of moral superiority if someone isn't conforming to them in the way that we say. You know, there's a far more dynamic relationship based on awareness in the moment with these things as points of reflection in life. And to quote one of the French Zen teachers, he said that to hold tightly to the precepts is to smash them. If we hold too tightly to anything, whether it's, you know, to not kill, anything, any of these, if we hold too tightly, it will smash them. We will smash them. And that is because we, by holding tightly to them, it means that we no longer are aware of them. As soon as you fix something, it stops and cuts awareness. As soon as you fix something, as soon as you are certain about something, it stops you being aware. It stops you being aware of yourself, it stops you being aware of others. And so certainty, we need to act, so we need to act with confidence, and that's okay, but that confidence should never be grounded in a moral certainty. It should always be a confidence which is open. To again quote Stephen Batchelor, he used the expression, the faith to doubt. He said that Zen practice is about the faith to doubt. We have faith that allows us to doubt, allows us to move with confidence but without certainty. That's what we must do. And so we have a dynamic relationship with these based on awareness in the moment, grounded in practice, not grounded in this is how things should be. It's grounded in practice, which means it can respond to the situation. And also that means to a certain extent it's a personal ethics. It means that different Zen practitioners will have different ways through this moral maze. And that will be grounded in their own lives, what they need to respond to, their own psychology. As I said earlier on, different people have. You know, I will never be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but maybe I might become a member of Doom Throwers Anonymous if something exists, you know, that kind of thing. So we respond to our own situation and we become aware of the way we get caught up in things. So I want to read something that it's in the booklet that the people who are being ordained receive, and it's written by Lana, Jose Lana. So I'm Jose Ho, Lana is Jose. Jose is she is the responsible for the Zen Dojo in London, and this is what she wrote. As we're all responsible for our own actions, we are also all responsible for observing the precepts using our own judgment and attentive concern, being constantly vigilant against the arising of self-righteousness and any tendencies we have towards holding rigidly to our various understandings. With the understanding that all of our actions are directly connected to consequences, which is the law of karma, we must each make our own decisions in each moment as to what choice we make and what consequences we accept. The precepts that we receive can guide us towards choosing actions in our daily life, which generally may result in more wholesome outcomes and less suffering to self and others. And so I think it really nicely captures, I think her words really nicely captured the spirit of this. And the other thing to say, and again this goes back to Jean, what he very much believed about this, what he believed, and not necessarily in some kind of cosmic way, but what he believed, and I believe too, is that the effect of doing this spreads. The effect of finding peace and awareness in your own heart mind in response to the conflict situations that are around, and manifesting from that space as opposed to a space of righteous anger, then you will find that it has a ripple effect, just as anger also has a ripple effect. Righteous anger also has a ripple effect. But this will have a ripple effect. And that happens naturally, unconsciously, also automatically. So effectively, we build peace, we reduce suffering by building it within our own heart minds first. So I'll finish there, and I'll open it if anyone's got any questions or comments, and also those online, I will check the WhatsApp group.